Welcome to Foreign Domestic and Forbidden, the ultimate international literature podcast hosted by Tim Trash and
Joaquin Lobo.
On this show, we explore the weird, wild, and wonderful world of literature from around the globe, from the most obscure stories to the infamous classics. Whether you're looking to expand your horizons or just want to get lost in a good story, this is the show for you. So sit back, relax, and join us as we take you on a journey to discover the hidden gems of literature from around the world. How do you like that one?
That was an amazing introduction. I love it. It's great.
It's the chatbot.
Yeah. Oh god. I'm speechless now. I don't know what to say.
Yeah, it's funny. It's really funny. So
did you ask, write me an introduction for the podcast?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. I typed in our names, I typed in literature, I think International Literature Podcast, and our title, and that was it. And that's what it came up with.
That's so funny.
Yeah, I know. That was the best one. There were others that were kind of a little sort of off, but they all follow a certain template.
Yes.
But then they change out the adjectives basically to either amp it up or tone it down a little bit. So,
well, yeah, that's I don't know what to say. I have been doing a lot of thinking on this topic. I sent you a link to a very interesting piece that was out. I don't know if in Wire or the New York Times. I don't remember. But definitely the topic of AI and whether it's going to start doing things that we don't want it to do, it's been very much in my mind these days.
Yeah, it feels weird to me because I feel that a lot of the technology probably out there that the scientists are actually working with right now is probably much more advanced than what we're getting at this point. And then they're rolling out right now new versions. I listened to a podcast where a journalist had gotten access to the newest technology that isn't widely available yet by Microsoft, and he was playing around with that, and he did sort of the same thing, let the chatbot write an intro to their podcast. And it's amazing. I mean, to me, it's really still, I'm sort of a bit flabbergasted at how okay it already is, because this is the infancy stage. Right. Sort of this is sort of the first internet where you have to type into something into the blue screen, and it will soon get better. And the possibilities are endless, to the point that we can actually have the chatbot imitate our voices and give mm-hmm. them prompts and write text, and they can talk to each other. So at some point we should definitely record an episode where we don't actually talk to each other but are replaced by chatbots.
Wow. It's going to make more sense than I could possibly make.
It probably will, yes.
Well, the thing is that this software has access to a lot more information that you and I could have. And yes. If you can sort of imitate a copy, not our voice or style of speech or voice, but anyone's, then we're on for a wild ride in the future.
Yeah. So if we were to feed the chatbot all our previous podcasts, they could probably, that would be enough for them to analyze our voices, create like use our speech patterns, and we could write them a script
basically. Yes.
Yeah. Which at some point we totally need to do.
Yeah, then we can take a break and go on a vacation.
Exactly. Exactly. Let the chatbot talk about it.
All right.
Yeah, the Oscars were on. We're not going to talk about them too much today. We're hoping to do that with our friend Mauricio at some point. We're having an awful time. Mauricio should have been on this show. We should have recorded last week, through some coincidences and misunderstandings and what have you, all of that failed. But he will come and we'll make it happen some way or another. But we will talk about something else, a little bit darker, a little bit weirder, and that is body and mind, especially broken in sort of quotation marks, broken bodies and minds in literature and beyond.
Yes, I mean, a sign of the times, no? We feel this fracture taking place in many different aspects of our lives, many different parts of our souls, if we kind of still use that word. And I mentioned last week how I gone through minor crisis with my back and yeah. You know, things that are new to me because I'm aging, and this kind of pain is something that I haven't experienced before. So nothing like a good dose of physical pain that takes you to the ER to come to terms with the fact that things break inside of your organism and things begin to happen at a certain point.
Yeah.
And you know, the relationship, you know, we had that podcast on moral pain and physical pain, the relationship that physical pain has with your emotions, your feelings, your thoughts, how that invades this other area of your life and begins to mess with the entirety of your own self. And I found that extremely interesting. I mean, I was used to seeing pain as something that I could detach from. Pain, it belonged to other people's lives. It belonged to other experiences. Pain I could read about in the New York Times. I could, you know, I could see it online and on film and on TV. But then this kind of pain begins to happen to you, and it's something completely new that no matter how sophisticated you think you are, you're not ready for it. You're definitely not ready to experience personal pain, unless you have always experienced personal pain. But when you have always been a healthy individual and begin to experience pain, it's something that you're not prepared for.
Yeah, I'm even stunned by the non-painful parts of getting older. Sort of my near eyesight is going away quickly. I can see okay if something is a bit away, but like any map, any text without glasses is just like a blur. My hearing is really shitty. I'm wearing hearing aids. I might have mentioned that before. And that's really weird to me, this and it always feels still urgent and new, even though I should be familiar with it by now. This losing things that you knew how to do and your body was able to perform these functions, and now the body is saying, no, I can't do that anymore. And this refusal to work with the mind, which doesn't really register how old it is, that feels still dangerous and weird and urgent to me. Like every morning when I put in my hearing aids, I'm like, what the hell? You know, I'm getting ready for the day, and it's weird. It has amazing little advantages that you can hike up the sound or lower the sound, which you can't do like with your normal ears, but the loss of immediacy, the loss of natural abilities, I'm very cranky about.
I because this is something, like I said, that usually used to happen to other people. I was also very interested in trying to remember depictions of pain in literature. I mean, film, I think, is everywhere, but literature usually deals with moral pain rather than physical pain. But I remember one of the books that I really love, and now, of course, it has been brought up as an example of appropriation by some readers. One of my favorite books from the 19th century French literature, Madame Bovary, where Gustave Flaubert offers an excruciating description of the pain suffered by Emma Bovary when she ingests poison. And I didn't know that. It took a reading of a great book by Mario Vargas Llosa, the Spanish Peruvian novelist, who wrote a wonderful essay called The Eternal Orgy, where he mentioned, I didn't know this, that Bovary was the son of a doctor, and that he grew up as a little child in this hospital. The father lived in this small provincial hospital where he used to witness or hear, at least, I don't know that he actually went inside these chambers, really excruciating dramatic surgeries that took place, like amputations, for instance, without any kind of anesthetics, because they didn't have any anesthetics at the time in anywhere. So, you know, the fact that this child was able to witness physical pain with that kind of intensity, I think that sort of gave him the ability later on to be able to depict physical pain, like the kind of pain that Emma Bovary suffers when she's poisoned. I don't know if you remember those really horrible scenes where she's dying and there's nothing that the husband can do, the husband who is also a doctor. But I don't know. I can really remember right now other books that made such a powerful impact on my reader's mind. That was definitely one of a kind, I'd say.
Yeah, but how old were you when you read that?
Probably I was like 20.
Okay. Yeah.
20 in translation in Spanish. Then I read it in English. Several different translations in English, and then I read it in French. It's one of the three books that I forced myself, with the help of a dictionary, to read in French.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about a little bit about a book that I very briefly mentioned in a previous episode, and that's Lucy Greeley's Autobiography of a Face. Lucy Greeley, at the age of 9, was diagnosed with Ewing sarcoma, a kind of cancer. And over the next years, she had a battery of surgeries, treatments, and basically, like they had to take out part of her jaw and try to reconstruct it. And so she grew up as a kid with this very disfigured face, and was, of course, at the mercy of her classmates, who would make relentless fun of her. And so she grew up with not only excruciating pain, but also sort of the stigma of being very different from everybody else and not being able to have sort of this unobserved life that many of us can have if we so choose. And the book started with an essay that I used to teach, Mirror Rings, and then morphed into a book. And her writing is very intimate, and it's just excruciating, this twofold pain of having to deal with a body that's betraying you, and a face and a bone structure that is betraying you, but also that marks you as other to people, and that won't ever let you escape from that. And so that always stuck in my mind. It's a very dark book, and it's beautifully written. It's a very lovely autobiography, but at the same time, it's also pretty heavy stuff. And just growing up with such severe limitations always struck me as especially hard. like during the days, like years when you the so-called formative years when you're starting to make plans, when you're starting to think about who you want to be in the world, when you're starting to create an identity, hers was always linked to the reconstructed phase.
What a haunting, powerful story. There's a difference, a qualitative difference between writing about your own pain or portraying someone else's pain. That's a very interesting filter. I remember a book that I read by Susan Sontag regarding the pain of others, which is a wonderful, dark, terrific essay on photography, where she points out to this problem, how to look at depictions of other humans' pain, the very serious moral considerations that have to go into place when you look at that and question yourself as a witness of pain. But when you talk about your own pain, then that's a very different story because you have to, well, you don't have to do anything. I mean, you just write about it and let the others deal with that. But I also imagine that at some point you there is this awareness of, you know, the things that you're sharing, the power that they have, what to share, how to share it, even why.
It's funny how we have, I think, as a society, become more aware of individual pains and how pain can play into the forming of an identity, how identity, pain, identity, body, mind are connected. And I think we have focused more on these differences in the past, maybe 20, 30 years than when we used to before that time. And so I think we have seen a lot of memoirs, a lot of books about these all kinds of conditions that make people feel they're not part of the quote unquote maybe mainstream. I don't know what you really want to call it there. I think more and more we're learning that there is no real mainstream, but still, so this perceived normal, quote unquote, normal contingent of people who don't have to deal with anything super tragic or otherwise. Although I think that's also probably a myth. But yeah, and so in some ways, I think we have come to identify who we are more in terms of afflictions. In the last 10, 15 years, there have been a number of essays on, for example, tinnitus, which I have like to a very low degree. But I noticed that, oh my God, there's all these essays suddenly popping up where I hadn't seen any like in my previous 40 years of life. I'd never come across anything like that. And so we're picking up on these things that people usually didn't talk about because maybe of shame. Because they didn't want to divulge that to others, because that would set them outside a certain group. But now we're talking about that, and it's at once liberating, but it's also strange sometimes for me to see how it becomes an item of identity, how it becomes a defining factor. And it's weird to me.
Well, I think that's related to several things. First, the sort of acceptance of memoir writing and autobiographical writing in this process of democratization of access to voice that the internet gave us. People with blogs, through blogs and through social media, had the immediate ability to share everything that they were thinking and feeling. And pain, of course, has such a prominent space in our lives that it became something very immediate to share with potential readers. I remember that it was Alexander Hammond, I think he's a writer from, where is he from? Czech Republic,
Where is
some
it
Eastern
from?
European country.
Yeah, Eastern European country. I
I
really
heard
don't
them
know
say
either.
once that memo writing is pain without imagination. That was before he wrote his own memoir, of course. And he was making the point that he would not write memoir because he believed that you could convey everything that needed to be conveyed in terms of the human experience through fiction. And that was one of the purposes of fiction, which I absolutely agree with. But this sort of attitude where the self, the personal voice became so prominent thanks to this acceptance and to this generalization, this demand even of these kind of books, then open the floodgate for a lot of people to feel that's what writing was about, that what's most important in writing is to talk about yourself and your own personal experience. Then came the popularity of auto fiction, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. I respect anyone's right to publish, write whatever they want to do, but to me, there's just something about fiction and the creation of characters that's so efficient and so elegant as a way of conveying whatever is happening to you without making it personal. On the other hand, I also think there is this culture of victimization. It became very convenient, very profitable, and very popular to portray yourself as a victim from, political figures. And I always go back to Trump, who made a lot of political gains by portraying himself as a victim of this system, everything is rigged, to cancel culture, with a very efficient way of finding support, love, and popularity is to present yourself as a victim of some injustice, to put yourself in the spotlight and benefit from whatever you can benefit when you claim your status as a victim. This, of course, is going to be a very unpopular statement, but I don't care.
Yeah, no, there is something to that. So to the Alexander Himan like statement, like in writing, in my writing, I would choose fiction too, because I feel whenever I start writing nonfiction, I start to spleen or fill up the pages with weird explanations of things that probably don't need an explanation. But there is something to me very immediate and urgent and wonderful about a person writing about their own experience with anything, really. Because it's if a fiction writer can imagine a character going through something horrible, let's say physical pain, like a depression, something, then we're still in the realm of made-up characters. It feels, yes, the author might understand us, and that gives us perhaps some modicum of solace. But when somebody is really saying, okay, this is how ugly and mundane and everyday my affliction is, that has a soothing effect to me and an informative effect on me that fiction can't quite match. It's this having a good friend who's saying, oh, like I have X, Y, and Z too, and let me tell you about how I dealt with it. And that's a little bit how I've felt. And I mean, I don't have depression, but I about 20 years ago, 25 years maybe even ago, I read an essay in the New Yorker. I was living in Buffalo, and I remember sitting in my kitchen at my wonderful yellow formica table and reading this essay by Andrew Solomon, and it was called Anatomy of Melancholy. And I was just really blown away. I had never seen anybody describe his affliction, his bout of depression so honestly and brutally, and it was wonderful. I mean, it was really like I still remember that even though it's so long ago. But I remember how impressed I was with this essay that chronicled his very, very dark turns in the relationships, where he would go out and just have sex with whoever, like never mind the AIDS crisis at the time, and just put himself in danger because that was the only way to feel himself. And that kind of honest, brutal honesty made a lot of sense to me, and I think unlocked a lot of the things that I had observed in my and my friends' lives, but was never able to put together. And so
that's a great point, and thanks for making me eat my words. Because I, as you were talking about Andrew Solomon, I was of course thinking of the book that our friend Mauricio Montiel wrote on his depression.
Yes,
which also sets him apart, because what Mauricio wrote a writer's book on depression, and he created a wonderful literary essay that traced the literary history of depression and explored depression as something that has been experienced by many great artists and writers in the West, at least, for the past few centuries. And what he was able to do, he not only dealt with this project as a catharsis, but it also shared a lot of very valuable information that has been extremely useful for many readers, including myself, who have dealt with depression, and that gave us a unique insight into the way in which he dealt with depression and how dark it got for him, and how through reading and film and art and music, he was able to somehow understand better the process of what was happening to him in those many years that he suffered depression. So I think there is a difference when you have someone like Andrew Solomon or Mauricio, who can look at personal depression, at the personal wound, and makes an effort to understand and put it in context, and offer to the reader a very valuable work that will help them understand how to look at this without thinking of it as the immediate collapse and the end of times. In that sense, I think yes, there is value in writing about personal trauma, but my comment was probably had in mind just the excess of this kind of writing that has given, you know, sort of permission to every single person to discuss personal pain in public forums. And that it might be just a cultural difference. I was raised in a culture in a family where you don't share with strangers what's happening to you. You protect your privacy, you protect that intimate world where you are in pain. I don't know that that's healthy, but that's how it is, how it was for me.
Yeah, I wonder that sometimes too, like how my relationship to pain or to public statements about pain, like is still part of my very restrictive upbringing, and sometimes I don't trust sort of my own judgment there, because sometimes I feel like you that because there's an interest in the publishing market about pain, people are encouraged to write about it, and pain becomes a bit of a, well, just like cheese and toothpaste, something you can sell in large quantities sometimes, and that we're making a living telling who can tell the most horrible story. And of course that has also been spoofed, this kind of writing where stories try to trump one another. But I grew up with a grandmother who was severely depressed, and she suffered for many years quietly, and then she couldn't take it anymore, and she admitted herself into a mental institution. And my family just hushed it. I mean, nobody wanted to talk about it, and it was a great source of shame to my family. And sometimes I think I'm still really reliving sort of their reaction to it, that I don't want other people to know that it's somehow like stigmatized and all that. And so whenever I read an essay like Andrew Solomon's, I'm very grateful that we can actually talk about that and that there is no shame in that. And yeah, some people might overdo it and look for things they can write about and look for ways in which they are beautifully sick and whatever. But by and large, I think it all helps removing sort of the stigma from being sick and just talk about it like, hey, this is something I have. Like, I have, like everybody basically has legs that are different, like they have different lengths. You know, one leg of yours is usually longer than the other. Like everybody mm-hmm. has that. Nobody thinks twice about that, you know. But yeah. If you have some other affliction, then suddenly, oh my God, you know, so to bring it all into a more normal realm where people can just say, yeah, I'm missing a leg, or I have horrible migraines, or I have arthritis, and that's the extent of it, and people understand it and don't go, oh, what is that, and how weird is that? I think that's probably a good effect of that kind of narrative.
You know, last night I went to see one of my favorite bands. It's a group called Daka Braka from Ukraine. They had a concert at the San Francisco Jazz Center.
Oh, cool.
And if there is one place right now on this planet where there's a lot of pain, that's in Ukraine.
Yes.
This band is amazing. They've been around for like 20 years, and they do this a folk band, but they of course they're playing folk with a very contemporary edge.
Yeah,
which is terrific. And of course, throughout the concert there was full awareness of what's going on in Ukraine. They were projecting some images of you know, bombs and at some point some video of destruction on a screen. At some point there was a projection of this slogans said Russia is a terrorist state and, you know, victory to Ukraine, things like that. And it was such a powerful experience to hear these very talented women. It's a band with three women and one man, which they have amazing voices. These women, it's just absolutely impressive what they do. And I kept thinking, this is how a country that's been destroyed sounds through the voice of its people. And they sang this beautiful, very powerful song to the people that have been killed, to Ukrainians that have been killed by the Russians, and this other song to the people that are fighting the invaders and so on. But at no moment, I mean, it was done with such elegance and dignity that at no moment you felt that they were portraying themselves as victims of anything. They were just singing their music.
Yeah.
And the place was full of Ukrainians from the Bay Area and, of course, people like me who were not Ukrainians, but, you know, that love this music. And it was such a beautiful, beautiful experience to see how pain can become something that's not, you know, that's forcing you to be depressed or to be mm-hmm. to commiserate in a way that's just, you know, not something that they clearly didn't want to do. It was not what they were there to do. They were not for anyone to say, oh, look at us, how much are we suffering? No, they were just so strong and full of dignity and pride. Yeah. It was really interesting. And of course, I mean, like I said before, anyone should have the right to deal with their pain in any way they want. And I'm free not to read books that I don't want to read. But I don't know, I just think that the realm of pain in my worldview is something that's very private and very personal.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm Ukrainian in that way. I think it's something that you need to deal with dignity and with pride.
Yeah, and in that sense, it's also, I mean, that is also a good example how it's not private, because the suffering is televised. The suffering comes via all the media into our living rooms, like everybody on this planet by now knows about it or should know about it. And so it's a celebration of resistance in the face of everyone knowing what you're going through. So it's private, and yet it's also not private at all, because, like, as a Ukrainian living in Ukraine, you can't be private anymore. I mean, there's no such thing in a way.
True.
I wanted to talk about one thing that has always fascinated me, and I'm aware that might be a little bit of, I don't know, affliction tourism on my part, but it's an affliction that is not painful. It's in one sense very benign, but entirely profound in its effects on the person and the relationships a person can have, and that's face blindness. Prosopagnosia is the term, but everybody knows it by face blindness. And Heather Sellers wrote a book about it. You don't look like anyone I know. And I heard her, I went to a reading of hers once, and it was stunning. And I had, I think, sort of a rudimentary knowledge of it, but I had never heard anyone who was afflicted by it, heard talk about it. And so face blindness is basically you can't recognize people by their faces at all. No one, I mean, not your husband, your wife, your children, sometimes even not yourself in the mirror. It's a neurological condition. Oliver Sacks wrote about it, and he had it himself. And it just wipes out any recognition. So people have to work around it and go, oh, you need to wear like that sweater I know, or this kind, these shoes that I know, and I will recognize you by them. But even friends they've had for many decades, they are unable to recognize. And it's a very exotic thing, but at the same time, it makes you profoundly lonely and isolated, and kind of like exposes you in a weird way to the world where you're not prepared to really talk to anyone, knowing like a friend could come up to you and start talking to you, and you might not recognize them unless you recognize them by their voice, and you have no way of orienting yourself in a group of people. People have to be introduced to you. Brad Pitt famously is suffering from that, and just like just imagine walking down the red carpet. We just had the Oscars, and there are all these people you worked with, people you know from the business, but you don't recognize anybody, and you're just imitating someone who does know who the other person is. And that has always struck me as one of sort of the most fascinating ways in which a mind is not really broken, but malfunctioning or not functioning to its usual potential. And endlessly fascinating, not to go around the world and not being able to know who you're talking to the next minute.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine how can you even make a living like that? How can you survive without knowing who you're talking to?
Yeah, she had this one anecdote that she was meeting a friend she was working with at a university, and they're meeting at a diner or a restaurant, and they're sitting in a booth, and she herself is facing the booth behind them, but her friend is not. There's just a wall behind Heather Sellers. And so the friend is starting to talk about the job and the dean and how the dean is like a terrible person or a terrible administrator, something like that. I don't remember exactly like what the, but she goes on and on and on in a loud voice, then turns around to the booth and recognizes that the dean has been sitting behind her. And she gets terribly mad at the author because, like, why didn't you tell me? He was sitting right there, and I'm going on and on about these people. But she just didn't recognize them. She couldn't recognize their faces. Right. And so it gets you into hot water all the time.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Even if we all know that deans are terrible persons. Even the deans know that.
Yeah, that's what they're getting paid to be. There's just no other way. I mean, yeah, that's an odd position.
Yes, I can only imagine. I mean, the idea of things malfunctioning inside of your brain is so interesting until it happens to you, I guess. And that, I guess, is also another risk of aging, growing up, when things start to malfunction, not only in your body, but also in your head.
Yeah.
And forgetting things, I think, is also one of those things that begin to happen to people when they age. We begin to forget stuff, and maybe not faces, but you begin to forget information.
And that forgetting names. Yeah, that happens to me now all the time. I will be going on about, oh yeah, in this 1976 movie with, and
I know.
And I know exactly who I'm talking about.
Yes.
I just don't remember their name.
Yes, it has happened to me in class. It's really embarrassing. I can't remember the title of a novel or the name of an author.
Because you look so old in that moment, you know.
I know. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I wanted to mention a couple of books that one of them I'm reading right now. It's A Neighbor from Oakland, or Own Home Girl from Oakland. I read this really interesting review, I believe, in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago. The book is called Saving Time, Discovering a Life Beyond the Clock by Jenny Odell. Jenny Odell is a neighbor. She lives close from here, from my house.
Oh, cool.
And she also published a book called How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy, which I love because that's one of my favorite things to do to not do.
Yeah.
To do nothing, I think, is something that is very misunderstood. I was telling my wife that how difficult it was for me to convey to her that going to the movies, I'm talking many, many years ago, to me was never a form of entertainment like it usually is for other people. Or even to read books when you're a kid, you know, when I remember my parents used to tell me, you're always reading books, why don't you do something else? Like, you know, reading, even though they were reading, they were readers themselves, there were a lot of books at home. But I read probably too much, and I should be doing something more productive, like studying from school, or you know, doing other things that were more productive than reading books. So this book is really interesting. I haven't read it. I read an essay, the original essay in which she based this book, sort of, you know, reclaiming that relationship that we have with time and how time is usually misunderstood. She makes a distinction between Chronos and Kairos, which are two. Chronos is the official time, the time we're used to using on our daily lives. We have watches, we have clocks, we have now in our devices, everything happens within a specific range of time. Yeah. But then there is this other time that takes place outside of that regulated time. Yeah. The time in which nature, you know, things happen in nature, the cycles of the moon, the cycles of the ocean, et cetera, et cetera. She wrote this very interesting study in this book, Saving Time, Discovering a Life Beyond the Clock, which also, you know, since we're talking of broken bodies and broken minds, it occurred to me that there are a lot of things that are broken in a relationship with a reality. We don't really know how to live without the constraints of these pressures, the pressures of being tied to a schedule, the pressures of being tied to cultural regulations that always tell us what to do, what not to do, how to do it, and how difficult it is to find ways of talking about healing and recovering from trauma, how to first realize that something is not working with these assumptions and how to move past these assumptions to hopefully have a healthier understanding of ourselves in this regulated context.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. I was just telling some people that in order to read a book, you need to be bored. You need to feel, oh, I could pick up a book now. That would be nice, you know, and to experience the boredom as pleasure and not as a deficiency or, oh my God, I don't know what to do with myself. But this leisure, this feeling yourself in the moment that is not filled with something else. So not looking at yourself as an instrument, but as a thing suspended in time and space. And so, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've long thought that clocks really don't have anything to do with time at all. And I'm somebody who loves watches, but I don't see them as connected to time at all. It's just something how we make appointments so that we're talking about the same thing and then no, but it never works when we're trying to schedule something with Mauricio. But we're trying to set an appointment, we're trying to schedule something, and that's where watch is of course somewhat helpful, but it's not how we experience time at all. Jean Gebser, the French philosopher, talked about that at length. And there are so many different modes in which we actually experience time. And just to give one example, and he used prayer as an example, but that can also be something else. It doesn't have to be necessarily prayer, but that when we enter the space of highest concentration, let's say meditation, we enter a model of time where time doesn't start, stop, or end. It's entirely self-contained. And as long as we stay in that space, in that mindset, time doesn't occur. If you're really, really heavily invested in meditation or prayer or love, you know, like if you're with your loved one and you're making love or you're just sitting there staring at each other, like time really, like in our modern model of time progressing from the past into the future, doesn't exist at all. And so once
that's very difficult to achieve. It's incredibly difficult to get to that point. I understand that about meditation, but timelessness, the moment where you can hopefully find that space to go beyond the pressure of time through meditation and through prayer, in my case, just create this vertigo and this fear, because I'm not used to it. I don't know how to access that without feeling extremely vulnerable. It's a little bit like going to nature, since I'm a city boy,
mm-hmm.
and I've never been in the wilderness. I don't have any desire to go to the, I mean, I've traveled a lot. I've been to many places, very remote places, in Patagonia, I mean, many, many places. But at some point, I feel extremely vulnerable when I experience something that's deeply unknown to me, and I feel endangered.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I could meditate and escape time, as I always know, but I it just freaks me out terribly.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, that makes perfect sense. I do think it freaks people out because you do lose a sense of self.
Yes, and control.
You know, and that's why, of course, like, we don't have to get into that, but like, that's why the French called like making love the little death, you know, because you give yourself right. completely, and it's a dissolution of self. You don't know where one body starts and the other body ends, and so meditation, prayer, whatever you want to call mm-hmm. it, you have to enter it and let go of who you are. And that's what I also like. I like your example a lot of traveling, because that's how I always feel when I go anywhere else but here. I'm suddenly like, woo, who am I? Like, nobody knows who I am, you know, like all the, like when I leave my house and there are the neighbors and they knew who I am, and I go to work and they knew who I am, you know, and there's this comfort in people recognizing you on some level.
Yeah, but then you're like the person who has face blindness, because you don't know anyone, you can't recognize
exactly that, you know. And nobody recognizes you either. You know, you're just like there. And everything that you thought you were is suddenly gone. It's like, and if you die there, if you should die, nobody will know who you are, you know. And it's a profound loss of sense of self. But that's also the beautiful thing, if you do it in a controlled space, that you can let go of that. But if you're heavily invested in a career, if you're heavily invested in a job, if you're heavily invested in sort of the little things, in material things, it gets harder and harder to say, all right, you know, whatever, you know, and it was weird, like when my wife and I lost everything and really everything was gone, it's an odd sense of, whoa, my whole identity is gone, you know, like this, these little things. Suddenly you're very naked and none of the things you surround yourself with say, I know you. And it becomes, again, sort of this odd blindness that people don't know who you are anymore.
I wish we had another hour to keep going. This is very interesting.
Yeah, but it's about the time that we have to do our recommendations.
Well, I already made a couple of recommendations. Let me just remind our audience of these two books. The one I'm reading right now, Saving Time, Discovering a Life Beyond the Clock by Jenny Odell, O-D-E-L-L. Her first book, How to Do Nothing. I can't wait to have some time to do nothing, reading this book, How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy, which seems extremely pertinent to our present lives these days. And I'm also going to recommend again this fantastic Ukrainian band, Daka Braka, D-A-K-H-A-B-R-A-H-K-A, Daka Braka.
Oh, cool. We'll put that in the show notes. My recommendation, have more coffee. It's raining cats and dogs again in the Bay Area, and it forces me to stay indoors more often than I would like to, because I'm already getting rained on like every time I go running, and like every day I'm just coming home totally soaked. And coffee, just more coffee. That's my only recommendation for a rainy, rainy day. Just drink more coffee, take slow. If you have time, do a little bit of a meditation and then have another coffee. So good to see you.
I was my friend.
Yeah, and hopefully you're not getting any leaks or whatever's. It's we're having another atmospheric river. This is the
Yeah.
Tuesday before it. The episode goes live on Thursday. So we have another atmospheric river and we'll continue through tomorrow morning.
Yep.
And it's just drenching us badly, badly, badly. But I mean, we can use all the rain we can get. So thank you for listening to another episode of Foreign Domestic and Forbidden, the ultimate international literature podcast. Please tune in again in 2 weeks when we should have an episode with Mauricio. And yeah, enjoy your 2 weeks. Bye bye, everybody.
All right.